Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with one of my favorite people in the world, Dr. Jennifer Michaels, Medical Director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County, Massachusetts' largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. She's board certified in both general and addiction psychiatry and has been in practice for over 15 years. Dr. Michaels joins us today to discuss mental health and substance abuse issues, particularly the dramatic rise in opioid and prescription drug abuse. Dr. Michaels, Jennifer Michaels, you are so welcome. You are a big part of what this station does, and thank you for being here once again.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Alan.
Okay, so the first question I want to ask you is this. In the credits that I read for you, which aren't nearly long enough, I left one out, and that is that you have a terrific relationship with the Berkshire Health Center Pittsfield. You want to tell us a little bit how your life works. Medical director at the Breen Center, but you also have an affiliation with BHS.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's unique. It's special. I don't think anyone has replicated it in the state, but I'm the medical director at the Breen Center doing community mental health work, but I'm hired by Berkshire Medical Center, and I'm on staff there. And so there's this unique relationship between outpatient work and inpatient work. We're all in it together. We're all under one umbrella. So I always tell my patients there's no escape from us because we're all talking, we're all communicating to help you. And it just strengthens treatment in our community.
Well, I know that Dave Phelps is the head of Berkshire Health Services and a terrific guy. Does he get enough credit for everything he does?
I think he probably doesn't because so much of this runs well that I think that sometimes you hear about problems. You don't always hear about a well-oiled machine. And so I consider this relationship a well-oiled machine. It's about 20 years old, and the group of psychiatrists involved in it and other support people are very happy and engaged.
Do you have a philosophical approach to psychiatry? You know, there are the Horneyites and the Freudians and the this's and the that's's, the Jungians. Do you follow any of those great gurus?
Well, I was fortunate enough to have an eclectic education at NYU many, many moons ago. But I've learned over time that my philosophy is whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if it's more of a psychodynamic treatment, fine. If it's more medication, fine. Or the best usually is blending services. It's kind of like a menu of options. And we pick with the patient what's best for that person.
And so you see patients, you treat them with medication if they have to, but you also talk to them, right?
We do the whole thing. If they need a residential program, we have a support program where people can live and learn techniques for recovery and wellness. And, you know, I think because I've talked with you for so long, many people think of the Breen Center as an addiction program, but the majority of our patients have behavioral health issues, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression. So we treat that too. And we treat people who have those problems co-occurring with substance use disorders. Mm. Very complicated issues, all under one roof.
So what is transference?
Transference? That's a great question. Transference has to do with the feelings that will arise in therapy towards your therapist that have to do with your past. So if I were treating you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you,
I sometimes feel you are.
Well, you're not supposed to know that, but okay, we let the cat out of the bag. Anyway, if I were treating you and you had certain feelings about me, and they could be very strong or not even rational.
I might see you as my mother, but
perhaps.
I might see you as an early girlfriend or something like that.
Could be, yes.
And
things can come up, like if we had an appointment and I had to reschedule, you might feel rejected, hurt that I didn't care about you. And it could be totally irrational, but that's transference. You're applying your feelings from the past to me in the present. And then it's an opportunity for us to work it out in therapy.
Now, I don't want to, you know, insult you, but you are a very pretty woman. And one of the things I wonder about and I worry about is all those patients who come in and fall in love with you.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the compliment. You know, I don't know about that. I mean, I know that people sometimes feel very good feelings about me because of the work we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes they may be frustrated with me because I haven't fixed them or cured them. I think what happens is we get down to business and that's the focus of the session.
But there may be something else going on. You're married to a wonderful doctor. Tell us about him.
Basil Michaels, who's a plastic surgeon who is very busy and doing well in Pittsfield. He has his own surgical center and a full array of services. And he's also a wonderful person. When we're not working, we're raising bees, raising children.
Raising bees?
Yes. Yes.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And you put on a mask and everything?
Oh, I suit up because I'm afraid of bees. Yeah. But once I'm suited up, I think I've brought honey here a couple of times, and it's just wonderful.
Now, basil, of course, is Greek, and you've gone back to Greece a lot, right?
We have. Yeah. And I recommend it to anyone who has that opportunity. It's so beautiful. You've been to Greece.
Oh, yes, twice.
Yeah. And Roselle, I think, is just recently gone.
Yeah. We had a wonderful trip not that long ago. Let me get back to substance abuse. What is it in our society, Jennifer Michaels, that is causing this incredible need to get high, either on opioids, and we find a lot of that, or now heroin, because heroin is less expensive than the opioids?
Than the opioids, yes. So to understand our current heroin epidemic, and it is an epidemic, we have to go back to the late 1990s. Because what happened then was a perfect storm of, you know, problems with opioid pills. And by opioid pills, I mean OxyContin, Vicodin, Percocet, fentanyl patches. At that time, there was a strong push from a variety of governmental agencies saying we're under-treating pain and we need to treat pain at any cost. And so doctors began, in my mind, over-prescribing all of these opioid pain pills or patches. And now we're paying the price of that because we over-prescribed. We began to prescribe Vicodin if you stubbed a toe or if you twisted your ankle. In the past, that would be treated with Tylenol or ibuprofen. And we gave large quantities. And 1 year, I think the statistics showed that doctors prescribed enough opioid pills for every grown-up, every adult in the United States to take opioids round the clock for a whole month of the year.
Were the drug companies involved in this at
all? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, were able to get labeling. This is just, you know, unbelievable. But at the time of its release, OxyContin was labeled as less addictive than other opioids because it was a time-released opioid pill. You know, you would take it and it would last 8 hours or 12 hours. It probably took a drug addict, you know, 2 seconds to realize if I crush it up, I remove the drug release effect and I'll get a very fast reaction. I'll be able to snort it or ingest it. And it's just as addictive as any other opioid. But it was released as less addictive. They were very aggressive in going to doctors' offices and talking about the benefits. And the focus was on people should not suffer with pain. Very erroneously saying, if you're in pain, prescribe opioids, because opioids don't really address the source of the pain. It just makes you not care.
Was it expensive? Were those original opioids expensive?
Well, there was a lot of money to be made.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of money to be made with the drug companies. Insurance covered those pills. On the streets, opioids are expensive. The pills are about $1 per milligram. So if you built up a tolerance and needed an 80 milligram pill of OxyContin, that would cost you $80.
Yeah.
And over time, what happened is with tolerance, you needed a bigger and bigger dose. You would price yourself out of opioid pills. And that's when heroin became, you know, a more affordable option.
So let's stay with the opioids for a little while. Were doctors aware that this was happening as this was coming down the pike?
I think some doctors were. I mean, I have worked a lot with addicts and alcoholics, so I was quite aware of it. And if you went to a conference, people were talking about it. But at the same time, that movement to address pain and consider pain the fifth vital sign was very active. So there was a lot of pressure on the community to prescribe opioids. There was another factor, too, though. Insurance companies stopped paying for the non-pharmacologic interventions, some of the longer-term physical therapies. Seeing a patient for half an hour or 45 minutes, that wasn't reimbursed. So what fit in instead was a shorter visit with a big prescription.
Well, isn't this one of the problems with modern-day psychiatry? I mean, we have different mental health helpers. We obviously have psychiatrists like yourself, MDs. Then we have social workers, MSWs often, but not always. And we have, you know, psychologists who can't prescribe. And so the social workers and the psychologists do talk therapy as opposed to the psychiatrists who do it all. And, you know, that leads to issues in which psychiatrists who used to be at the lowest end of moneymakers in the medical professions, along with pediatricians, interestingly, started to make money because instead of talking to somebody for an hour, they talked to him for 15 minutes and gave him a prescription.
Well, it's not that lucrative with that model either. It's just probably less satisfying. So
to you.
To me.
But you will say that there are people who prescribe and who are making a lot of money on it.
I'm sure there are. I don't know those people, but okay. I can tell you that in community mental health is done for the love and the commitment. It's not done for the salary. So there probably are people out there who have figured out a way to maximize the income. The difficulty we have is that insurance companies often will not pay for us to perform therapy. So I'm trained, you asked me before about transference. Sure. It brought me back to my residency days when we learned about psychoanalysis and the psychodynamic therapies. I'm trained to do all of that. And yet, for a long period of time, insurance companies would not reimburse for that kind of therapy from a psychiatrist, but instead from a social worker or a non-medical provider. So that left the psychiatrist being what's called prescribers. And it's sad because the best treatment in my mind is integrated treatment.
Sure, both.
Yeah. So, you know, we're now, because of the changes in billing, we're now able to do a little bit of therapy. But I actually have a private practice because I love doing therapy, and it's hard to be able to do that with traditional clinical settings now.
So if you don't mind, and maybe you do, I mean, I don't want to violate any confidences here, but give us an idea about what a patient who's been hooked on opioids might be like, if you can sort of just tell us what a visit might look like.
Sure. Well, I want to make sure people are aware that there's no stereotype. You know, in my mind, if I look at the past few weeks, I have seen a physician, a nurse or two.
Interesting.
Yes.
Do physicians often get addicted?
To opioids. Yes. More likely to pills. Yes. Yes.
More likely to pills.
Pills.
Meaning what?
Like Vicodin, Percocet,
I see, Percocet.
Or fentanyl. We see that risk, especially with anesthesiologists or people who work in an operating room. But they certainly do. They certainly are at risk.
What happens to them?
Well, hopefully they live, because it's important to remember that people die from these diseases.
How so?
They overdose and die. I mean, the opioids suppress your breathing center in the brain.
Interesting.
So you lose your drive to breathe, and you stop breathing, and that's how people overdose.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were saying that you've seen different kinds of people.
Every kind of people. Let's put it that way. I mean, I don't know if we've talked. I have two boys at home who are on summer break, and they're playing video games and playing lacrosse. And then I went to work, you know, after seeing them off in the morning and they were playing. And I went to work and I saw someone a couple of years older who was addicted to heroin, who graduated from a local high school and was a lacrosse player and liked video games. And it was kind of this sad, uncomfortable feeling to look at this boy and say, you know, you should be home playing games with my kids, not shooting up heroin.
Stay with the opioids for one more minute, because I find it so fascinating. You mentioned Percocet and mm-hmm. you mentioned the other opioids. What distinguishes each?
They're all cousins. They're all related.
Interesting.
You know, if you think about opioids, they're a class of substances or medications. They all are derived from the opium poppy, Papaver somniferum. That's the technical name. But from the poppy, that type of poppy, you get morphine and codeine and something called thebaine. And those are the naturally occurring opioids. From those, we tweak the molecule. We add on a few little chains and branches, and we create other chemicals. And all of them are related in that the chemicals bind to our brain opioid receptors and cause an opioid-like effect. I can tell you what that's like, but you probably
know. No, I don't want to hear it.
Okay, so they all bind, and some of them bind very strongly.
When you say bind, what does that mean?
Well, if you think about a receptor, kind of like a launching pad in your brain, that's what a receptor looks like, and then you add the molecule that, or the spaceship that fits in that launching pad, and it fits either really snugly and perfectly, that will have a strong opioid effect. Or maybe it fits, but not so well, and it's not a tight fit, that will have a partial opioid effect. And then the other thing to think about is how long that opioid effect is. Some opioids last a very short time. Some last
the bind that lasts short
time. Yeah, are biologically active and bind for a short time. Now, those opioids, like heroin, will lead to a very fast response, a feeling of high or rush that addicts seek, and then a withdrawal, which could happen 3 or 4 hours later. What happens? You go for more. And that's why people addicted to heroin are using 4, 5, 6 times a day, because their brain is on this roller coaster of binding, intoxication, withdrawal. But heroin's related to the ones that we think of as therapeutic, like methadone in methadone clinics, or a fentanyl patch, or Vicodin or Percocet. They're all related. And actually, heroin has been used therapeutically. It's odd to think of it that way. It's still used therapeutically in hospitals for severe pain. I mean, and it points to the fact that all medicines can be used in an addictive way or in a therapeutic manner.
So I'm fascinated by this. I was on the west side of Manhattan when the Nicewanders came along with methadone, and I wrote the first governmental report on it, and if one wants to go to the New York State Archives, you can find it. But it was always supposed to be a more manageable substance than the heroin. Has it turned out to be true?
It is. It is. What's better about methadone is it's very long-acting.
Yeah.
It's administered orally. There's no injecting. And the way the government set up treatment, it's monitored very closely. So methadone for opioid use disorders is provided in the clinic. Usually the addict comes in every day and his or her ingestion is monitored. What's happened,
though, monitored meaning you're watching them because sometimes they sell it.
Correct. But it's very complicated, Alan, because this is what's going on now. So only those clinics that are monitored so closely can provide methadone for opioid use disorders. Mm-hmm. But let's say, God forbid, you have some severe pain syndrome. You go to your doctor can write for methadone for pain.
Can they?
Yes, in a very unmonitored way. And so methadone is currently either the number one or number two drug associated with overdose deaths. And it's not the methadone from clinics, because that's monitored so closely. It's the methadone from your physician who's writing for methadone for your pain. But it's not so black and white, because an addict may go to his or her doctor and say, I'm in pain. The doctor doesn't know he's treating someone who has a substance use disorder and write for methadone.
Do people tell you when they come to see you what it is that got them started?
Oh, yes. I ask everyone.
And what are some of the answers?
For the vast majority of people, it's very insidious. You know, most people who end up using heroin started out with pills, and most people who started using pills got those pills from friends or family. So it wasn't the scary, nasty drug dealer on the corner.
You may have gotten it out of the medicine cabinet.
Yes. The medicine cabinet is the drug dealer for most people.
Wow.
Yeah.
When I had my back operation, I got prescriptions for opioids.
How many did your doctor?
I have no idea, because I never opened the bottle.
You never took one?
Not one. It scared the hell out of me. And, you know, I've had so many visits with you, Dr. Michaels, that I just say, I'm not going there. I'm not having any of that stuff. So there I was. My medicine cabinet had this thing. And I called the police department and said, do you accept this stuff? And they said, yes, you have to bring it over here. I said, I'd like a receipt. No, we don't give receipts.
They don't.
And I think receipts are important, because if that bottle shows up somewhere else, I'd like to be able to say, here, I delivered it to the police department on so-and-so date. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I get what you're saying. I think the way it works is you bring it in, they collect it, it gets incinerated. So it doesn't go, you know, you can even just bring it in unmarked. So you could bring it in and you won't get a receipt, but it just gets
I think it's important to do it. Let's go back to the people who come to see you. And it's a very important point you make about the insidious thing. Is it just sort of, well, I'll just try this, a sense of adventurism, or is it keeping up with colleagues or other children? Or
I see a few different points of entry. You know, like that young person I mentioned who feels like he should be home playing with my kids and is instead shooting up heroin, but hopefully sober today. He was an athlete, and he got hurt in high school and got some opioid pills because he hurt his back and he liked them. And other athletes in his class had a similar experience, and then they all started to enjoy using opioids, and then they would fake injuries.
Oh, boy.
They started to fake injuries. They knew who would give them what. And they graduated as a group from pills to heroin.
There used to be a doctor in New York and had some exposure in the Berkshires called Dr. Feelgood.
I think I know that doctor.
Yes, Dr. Feelgood. And he would come to the Berkshires, and he actually supplied some very famous people with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say they know who will give them the drug, where they get them, they're obviously medical practitioners who should know better.
Yes, and it's very painful. The vast majority of physicians are not providing these opioids that are fueling the epidemic. It's a small number. And I think the DEA is getting better at focusing in on these people. Mm. There was a great article, I think, recently in The New Yorker about a physician who felt, I don't know if you saw, I had a chance to read it, but a physician who felt strongly that he was helping people, and he was actually killing people because he was vastly overprescribing pills. And, you know, what's difficult, I've worked with physicians in that position who are overprescribing. They are the most loved physicians. Patients will say to me, nobody was as good as Dr. Smith, and nobody helped me the way Dr. Smith. And you know, I have to bite my tongue and say, well, Dr. Smith almost killed you with fentanyl patches for psoriasis, you know, or something like that.
Mm.
So it's almost like a filet à deux, you know, a collusion between doctor and physician. Doctor feels great that he or she is helping, and the patient's addicted and has an endless supply of pills.
Well, you're a trained psychiatrist, obviously, and quite famous in our region. And no, I mean, you really are, and it's wonderful and deserved. But do you ever, when somebody comes to you and talks to you about what happened to them, a failed love affair or this or that, do you ever say, you know, oh boy, you know, I can relate to this on a personal level, not a professional level?
There certainly are patients who will elicit strong feelings back. There's not just transference, there's counter-transference. And those are the feelings that the therapist feels towards the patient that often have to do with his or her past. I am a mother. I'm a very protective person.
Indeed.
So certainly when people come in and they've been abused in some way or they need a mother, my inner mother wants to take care of them. And I have to watch that because I can't just be a mother. That's not really why they are seeing me. I will advocate for my patients very strongly.
What does that mean?
For example, if I have a patient who is doing well, doing what they need to do in recovery, and
needs a job,
I will help them to get a job. Or if they're on probation, I always say to them, I love nothing better than to write a positive letter to the judge or probation. So do what you need to do so I can write that letter, you know.
Do they play you?
I'm sure I've been played, you know, and any physician who thinks that, you know, I always know or I can read minds, I have to laugh because that physician is deluded. I'm sure we've all been played. You know, I talk to my patients about lying about their use or lying about their
behavior. Well, drug addicts are famous liars, aren't they?
Yes, and I say to them, look, if you lie to me, you got over, you fooled me, but who's the victim of that lie? Not me, but you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have lost an opportunity to help you.
Now, you come from, well, you're practicing in the Berkshires, but in a place, Pittsfield, which has had its troubles. What creates the need in a community? What makes it an epidemic?
I think it's multifactorial. I think poverty, loss of jobs, lack of opportunities for feeling good in other ways. And then you have a history of addiction, a pro-substance community. You know, if you can look at communities and the density of liquor stores will predict the density of alcoholics
in
a community.
Is that right? Interesting.
Yeah. And our whole country has the problem. You know, it's not just us, but we're in the middle of a national epidemic. But we have a pro-substance culture. I'll give you an example. If we look at our use of opioid pills and compare it to the rest of the world, we consume 66% of the world's supply of opioid pills, the United States. So we have a culture that promotes taking pills, taking substances. And we also consume the majority of illegal substances, the United States.
What's the relationship between smoking and addiction, other addictions?
Other addictions? You know, that whole gateway drug theory, which I hate to talk about because...
You always get garbage back.
Yeah, it's antiquated and people line up on either side of that gate. I much prefer looking at a young person smoking cigarettes is learning, is wiring the brain for a reward from a substance, which makes it more likely that he or she will find other substances rewarding.
And what is it about those young people who start to smoke? I've never understood it. They know them. We all tell them. Mm-hmm. They hear it over and over and over again. You know, you're going to get cancer. You're going to live a shorter life. And yet we see them doing it. And I've never quite understood what makes them start.
Did you ever smoke?
Never.
Never. Okay. Well, I smoked. I was one of those young children. I mean, I was maybe 13 or 14. And my friends were smoking and we tried it. And I got hooked. And I was addicted.
Wow.
And I knew all of that stuff, but that wasn't the focus. I mean, denial is a wonderful mechanism when you're using a substance. It's a wonderful way to just enjoy your addiction because you are addicted. It's not like smoking is relaxing or calming. The reality is when I'm addicted, I smoke, it alleviates my withdrawal symptoms. But people feel like it's helping them to feel more relaxed.
So do you think if somebody's addicted on one level, for example, to cigarettes, that mm-hmm. they're more vulnerable to other addictions?
Yes, yes, especially a psychoactive substance. So what I mean by that, if someone is addicted and using alcohol, intoxicated, they're more likely to make bad decisions about other substances. Mm. And a lot of addiction is about crossing lines. Like, I would never do this. However, if I'm desperate or I'm intoxicated, no, maybe I'll just do it this once. And then that becomes the new normal. And I see that again and again with the people I treat.
Let's talk about marijuana.
Okay.
We've been down this road before. You have in the past said it is a gateway. Now you're saying, let's stay away from that term. But is somebody who gets high on marijuana going to be looking for other highs?
Someone may be. There are other factors. The biggest predictor of substance use in general is having a family member who's a substance user. So if somebody is genetically vulnerable.
Interesting.
Yes.
So you think that's the case, right? That we're going to discover the gene which leads to addiction?
I think it's polygenomic. I think it's more than one gene. But I think that we're starting to understand that there's something different about their dopamine system and the genes.
And the dopamine does what again?
It's the reward system. And dopamine is a very rewarding neurotransmitter in the brain. And so all drugs of abuse and even all addictive behaviors, compulsive behaviors, release dopamine. And essentially all pleasurable activities, you know, food you like, sex, seeing a person you like, release dopamine. It's a very gratifying, I feel good neurotransmitter. The difference is drugs of abuse release dopamine orders of magnitude greater than our usual activities that feel good. And so it hijacks that part of our brain.
You know, I'm going to be 73 years old, and I have a question for you. I was told when I used to do some volunteer work out at Daytop Lodge and Village out in Staten Island.
You've done so many wonderful things.
Well, it wasn't much, believe me.
But that's wonderful. I remember Daytop.
And they used to send me out there, and I saw some very, at the time, primitive ideas, putting people back in diapers and putting mm-hmm. dunce caps on their heads mm-hmm. and or shaving their heads and doing that kind of thing. Did that work?
It was the punitive model of treatment. And I think that it worked for some people. And, you know, for other people, it was of no value or may have helped them to count the days until they got out to get high again.
Mm-hmm.
I treated some of the graduates of Daytop. I remember one of the most concerning parts of that treatment was that they didn't realize that if you were a heroin addict, you also were an alcoholic. And so many of the people who went to Daytop were, quote unquote, cured of their heroin addiction, but they left and they became alcoholics. You know, and that's an example of how your brain is wired for addiction and it doesn't care. Any substance will do. As far as the punitive treatment model, I do not agree with it. I think that it dehumanizes people, and I think that it also further stigmatizes this disease. And we have much more humane treatments that are very effective.
The reason I mentioned 73 is that I was told at the time, and I don't remember where I heard it, but that if you were an addict and you could stay alive to 35, that things would get better, that was when your chances, if you could stay alive that long. Is mm-hmm. that true?
Recent data shows that people who are most likely to die from this recent epidemic are actually in their 40s.
Uh-huh.
So I guess the big question is, are you a sober addict in your 30s or a using addict in your 30s? Because people are most likely to die from opioid use disorders in their 40s. And then I think the next most common group is in their 30s. So I don't believe that's still the case.
Talk to me about criminal justice. You mentioned our DA a couple of minutes back. What role should our criminal justice system play? There are those people who think we should legalize drugs because we're not doing anybody any good this way. Should district attorneys and police be very active in rounding up people who are addicts?
I think it's complicated because when people are...
That's why I love having you here, because it is complicated.
It's so complicated. And I think when people are using drugs, they often engage in illegal activities. And
do they tell you that?
Oh.
When
I
you
mean,
say, where do you get the heroin? They say, well, I have to steal to get it.
One way or another, I know that. And some people come to me. The motivating factor is they've been arrested.
Mm.
And I treat my patients with respect. I let them know when they're ready. We're there for them. So I'll give you an example. A young man who really didn't want to get help, a heroin addict. He had one foot in the door and one foot out and ended up leaving us about a year ago and came back this year because he had been arrested for heroin possession, I think. And this time he was ready to get help and he's done beautifully. He's in our halfway house. He's serious. He needed that consequence.
Mm.
He's on probation. It really helped him to look at his life. Like, do I want to have a rap sheet? Do I want to go to jail? Or do I want to be sober and go back to school and finish my education?
You know, in New York State, Jennifer Michaels, in New York State, Rockefeller and Lindsay both decided on the non-punitive way of doing it. They had all kinds. They bought motels. They were thinking about buying the Queen Mary, you know, just so that they could have all these addiction programs. And then Rocky got disgusted. And out of that came, because he was a guy who wanted fixes. I don't mean that addictively.
And not that kind of fix.
and so that led to the Rockefeller drug laws, you know, in New York, which we have now revisited, which is, you know, people were going to go to jail. We needed a lot of prisons, and that led to a prison industry. And yet, we had an experience in Great Barrington years ago in which one of our public walkways became virtually impassable. There were so many people and so much drugs going on.
Huh.
And the DA stepped out, our present DA, stepped into it and with a drug task force, cleaned it up. And the town has been much better since then. One wonders whether those people literally stopped or whether they went somewhere else.
Well, I don't know what happened to those people, but I can tell you that addiction is a chronic disease.
Yep.
So it's a disease.
What does chronic mean again?
Chronic means they have it for life. The analogy I use is diabetes.
Yeah.
If you think about diabetes, you know, we don't currently have a cure, but we have excellent treatment.
We do.
The person who suffers with diabetes, who is very compulsive and committed to recovery, will end up pushing that disease into remission. You know, they can have normal lives, they take medicine, they live a certain way.
In the old days, they used to die at 35 or 40.
They die.
Yeah.
And in much the same way, addiction, which is a parallel chronic disease with treatment, commitment, compulsion to do it every day, people can live wonderful lives. Part of why I love my job is I get to see these desperate people who really are at the bottom of the pit. You know, they may be homeless, legal issues, alienated by family. They build themselves back up, and they often go into fields to help other people because their addiction has impacted them so greatly.
So if you got them a job, or if you got them a house, or if you got them an apartment, would they be less likely to be addicted?
First of all, they're getting their jobs. I'm, you know, encouraging them, giving them phone numbers.
You. No, yes. I don't mean you.
I wish I could. Yes.
I should have said if this is society.
Society.
Yeah, yeah.
And the answer is yes, because if you think about that brain that is hijacked by drugs, you know, your feel-good neurotransmitter is so out of whack because it's looking for that hit to have dopamine released so that seeing a family member, having sex, you know, eating that cookie, dopamine doesn't even register anymore. We need to help them feel good, to feel rewarded, to feel challenged, so they reclaim their brain from addiction. And so the house, the job, the relationships, all that stuff is about reclaiming your brain. And I look at it as almost like cancer, you know, squeezing out that disease of addiction, denying it of a blood supply in your brain and using your blood supply for healthy rewards, rewiring.
So of the people who come to see you, how many end up really being cured? In other words, being able to go on the diabetes model you've just given us?
Well, no one's cured. I always say we can't cure that. You have an incurable disease, but we can treat it and we can get it into remission. So I wish I could cure it, but, you know, in remission. The majority of people we treat, and I have to say, we have an incredible team at the Breen Center, Gail Ashore, Candy Mahoney, Sessa, and Bob Cote, these wonderful people, very committed for decades, who provide the therapy, the day treatment, residential programs. It's a wraparound treatment. If someone wants it, they do very well. 75-80% of people will have long-term recovery. Some people come to us and really don't want our help. They just don't do well. They show up because someone...
That's the danger of the DA saying, you either go to jail or go to see Dr. Michaels.
If they don't want it, it just, we don't have a magic wand. I wish, you know, we could do something, but we treat people with dignity and respect because we hope that maybe next time when they're ready for treatment, they'll feel they can come back to us.
Yeah. Well, I recently read an article in paper, maybe it was the Times, which talked about a new group of healers who were basically saying that the old 12-step model doesn't work, that there are other ways of dealing with this. I wonder whether you could critique the 12-step model, you know, the Alcoholics Anonymous or the Drugs Anonymous or whatever, and say what you found.
I think that no one treatment works for all people. So I'm really glad we have a variety of treatment models. And for some people, 12 steps is life-saving. It works for people who are more severely addicted. So if you have more of a mild case of addiction, you may go to a meeting and say, I'm not like them. I'm not so bad. And,
sure.
And hey, I don't have a problem. I'm going to go drink. So it doesn't work as well if you have more of a mild addiction. And you need to go to meetings, get a sponsor, find a home group. But it's almost like building a sober family. And it works for people who are invested in that way. And then some people I treat, they go to meetings, it doesn't click. Well, then we try something else.
But when they go, the first thing they have to do is stand up and say, hi, I'm this, and I'm an alcoholic or I'm an addict. Do some people just have a lot of trouble with admitting that they are?
Yes. And you can also say pass. You're allowed to say pass in those meetings.
Oh, you are. Yeah.
You are. That's allowed. And I treat people who still question, am I an alcoholic? Am I not? And it's not a good fit. It's the same thing with a therapist. You want to find the right fit. You know, you go and you want to feel like, I could talk to this person. This person can help me. When you go to a meeting, you need to feel the same way.
Well, we haven't talked a lot about alcoholism, but alcohol, of course, kills a lot of people.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's roadkill. So when you're treating an alcoholic as opposed to somebody who is addicted to drugs, is there a technique that's different?
Well, some of the medications are different, obviously. So so some of the medicine we might provide to help a person with alcohol cravings are different than what we would use for opiate addiction. We might support going to AA more aggressively because that's more tried and true than some of the other 12-step programs. But relapse prevention works for all forms of addiction.
What does that mean again?
Relapse prevention is helping someone identify, what are my triggers? What are my vulnerabilities? Who are the people that make me feel like I want to use? Well, some are obvious. If I run into my drug dealer, I'm going to want to use. But maybe it's my mother-in-law who tells me I'm a bad person and I should be doing all these things and I'm a bad mother. Maybe when I see my mother-in-law, that's a trigger. And how do I prevent using when I'm triggered by my mother-in-law? So those techniques are actively employed, the kind of searching the vulnerabilities and looking for other outcomes and other supports so people feel like they have options.
So when you create this Breen Center, you're the medical director, you have all these people working with you, how do you get them to come in the door without feeling everybody's watching them?
Well, what a great question, Alan, because I mean, I have to tell you, I have people in my private practice who will say, I don't want anyone to know I see you because you're that addiction doctor. You know, they're seeing me for,
because you're a psychiatrist.
Or because you're a psychiatrist. I don't want to walk in that door. So stigma is a huge impediment to treatment. And it's so unfortunate. If you look at the World Health Organization data on stigmatized disease, addiction is number one on the list. So what do? We try to be very kind and gentle and supportive. We try to destigmatize by talking about it being a disease. It's not that you're immoral. You just have a very unfortunate disease that leads to behaviors that you probably would not engage in if you were sober. And we try to help people separate out who they are from this bad disease. It's a part of who they are. It's like being stigmatized because you have cancer. It used to be like that 3 or 4 decades ago. You know, the people never said the C word. They never went to the doctor until it was too late. We didn't even tell family members that they had cancer because it was so bad. Now we have posters, we have ribbons, we have races. That's my hope for addiction.
When I was an NIMH fellow, National Institutes of Mental Health.
Alan, what have you not done? Well, Can I ask you?
They paid for my doctorate. It was great. The NIMH took a group of people and they made us all political scientists, and there was a program so that we could organize later in life. There could be an organization where I could use what you'd learned to help people, because there's an old saying that mental patients don't always have membership organizations or political organizations, and that's why they paid for this, and that's why I like to have these kinds of conversations, because I feel in some way I'm paying back a little bit.
Well, it's a good deed. It really is.
Yeah, but when I was a fellow, they were talking about how there would be no more stigma in 20 years, 15. That hasn't happened.
How did they propose that that would happen?
People would understand. There would be more public recognition. I remember once I decided that, you know, the pressure of PhD was just too much. I had to get a little therapy. But I didn't have enough money. So I went to borrow some money at the NYU office. And I was sitting outside waiting for my time. And I heard one guy say to the other, some nut is coming in here, wants us to pay for his therapy or to borrow money for therapy, which I considered to be symbolic of what the problem was back then and frankly, now. I mean, I don't think it's changed that much.
So did you get up and leave or did you get your money for therapy?
I don't remember. I think I paid for it myself. I figured out a way.
But that's so, you know, emblematic of the issue. And I think we're working on it. We're working on empowering people. And part of it is a huge recovery movement. Instead of warehousing people in state hospitals.
Yeah, we don't do that.
We don't do that. And we're also looking at what they can do and what they're comfortable doing and finding meaning in life, a job, volunteer work, helping others, mentoring others. And I find that helping others is very healing for all of us. You know, so someone with a severe mental illness can obtain stability and then mentor someone else. And that is so healing for that person.
Right. So we started by talking about, you know, addictive drugs. We went on, we've talked about alcoholism to some degree, and we've talked about the relationship between, you know, one's parents and others who create this need to be an addict. If the United States gets to the point where we're not taking care of our young people, where there are no jobs, can we expect a rise in addictions?
I think so, yes. I mean, if we have a whole cohort of unemployed people, young people who aren't feeling gratified and challenged in more ideal ways, I think they're at risk for substances, definitely.
What about the myths? I mean, we see a lot of young women, for example, smoking a lot. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to them, it comes down to weight sometimes. You know, if I smoke, I'm not going to be eating. Is that a myth?
People who smoke usually do weigh less. And when you stop smoking, you gain on average 5 or 7 pounds. Mm-hmm. But I always say to people, you know, you'll be a really skinny corpse. Do you want to be a skinny corpse at 60 or a little chubby, you know, corpse at 75.
Do they understand the consequences?
Well, you know what? Everyone has a different button to push. So for some of my patients, what works best is I calculate their annual cost for continuing to smoke, and it could be $4,000 or $5,000. And then I talk to them about, well, okay, let's think about it. What would you do with that $5,000 if you weren't smoking? And it could be a trip to Disneyland with the kids, a new car. And that resonates. For other people, it's their grandkids. For other people, well, once I explain to them, you've kicked all these other habits. If you stop smoking, you are less likely to relapse with your other drugs. Many people feel if I stop smoking, then I'm going to need to drink again, or I'll go back to opiates. They don't understand that the way the brain works is if you kill your nicotine addiction, it makes it less likely that you will engage in any substance use.
Now, the police have a mandate in many places to carry a substance which will, if somebody is overdosing, will bring them back. What is
that? Yes. First of all, I think it's wonderful. It's overdue. It's called Narcan. And so I talked to you about opiates binding to your brain and activating your brain. What Narcan does is it knocks all of the opiates off of your receptors, and it's a blocker. So you go from being very intoxicated, maybe not breathing, if you're given Narcan, you will go from almost dying to being unbound with opioids and living.
Well, Dr. Michaels, why can't we, I mean, I know this is probably going to be a very naive question, but why can't we give addictive people Narcan as part of their treatment?
Some programs do that, and there's now a move to make it over the counter.
Is there any downside to the stuff? Does it hurt you?
No, it's very safe. I mean, the only downside is that if you've ever witnessed somebody who is in overdose getting Narcan, they will go from lying on the ground, being unconscious in a coma, to waking up instantaneously and being very angry with, you know, they'll be angry because they're in acute severe withdrawal. That's the only downside.
Have you ever been there? In other words, has anybody really gotten so angry that you were in fear of your well-being?
Well, not related to addiction. I mean, yeah. I've worked in a VA. I've worked at Bellevue Hospital. So right. There have been some violent interactions, but not during substance use treatment ever.
Why do you think that is? Are addicts generally not violent people?
I think when people are intoxicated, they're more likely to be violent. But by the time they come to treatment, they're hopefully not intoxicated. And you know, I've been doing this a very long time, so I guess I've developed a style that is calming and compassionate. That's my goal. And I have, knock on wood, it has not been confrontational.
And how do you, Jennifer Michaels, how do you keep in touch with all the other people who are doing what you're doing around the United States? How do you know what's working and what's not?
Meetings, readings, internet. I just recertified for my second time, board recertification in addictions. So that was a very...
How do you do that? What do you do?
Oh, it's a lengthy project. You have to, read everything that's out there about the most up-to-date treatment modalities and go to a review class, study, big textbook, and then go... I was in Albany and took a computer test maybe a month or two ago.
Never came to visit?
No, I could... Yeah, but it was a big deal, and I am up to date because things change. I need to be up to date.
There are always doctors who don't stay up to date, and that's a danger, right? Can you give us an example of something contemporary physicians and doctors ought to know, but that they don't?
Well, you mentioned Narcan.
Sure.
Narcan saves lives.
Who invented that?
Oh, it's 30 or 40 years old.
Really?
Yeah, it's been around for decades. It's underutilized. And we're just now getting to the point where first responders have it available.
Sure.
We're training people. There's a move now that I support that families of addicts should have it available and should have a training so they know how to use it. And it can be purchased over the counter. And I think in New York, there was a bill supporting that. I don't know what happened with the bill.
Do you know of anybody who's ever been harmed by Narcan?
No, I do not.
Interesting.
You're not going to overdose. You're going to go through withdrawal. And withdrawal from opioids is not life-threatening. It just feels like the worst flu you've ever had times 10.
I knew a doc who's passed now, but who had been addicted to opioids. And he was thrown out of the medical profession as a result of that. Is that appropriate?
That's a great question. I have treated physicians who are in physician health service because of an addiction to either alcohol or opioids, and they've received extensive treatment and extensive monitoring. And I know of another physician who is someone recovering from opioid use disorder. I think that we have evolved to understand it as a disease, and I would hope somebody suffering from it would not be kicked out, but would be treated.
Right.
So, that's the current model.
But there are still punitive models. This guy was down south, and, he was in deep trouble with the law. They never prosecuted him, but he did lose his privileges in the South.
Well, and then what happens, it can get complicated in that doctors can write prescriptions
to themselves
and also
it's
to
exactly
patients.
Exactly what happened, by the way.
Yeah. So
and also to patients, you're saying.
To patients, and then the patients fill it, and the doctor will pay them. I mean, there comes a time when they cross a line that's so far from appropriate practice that they may lose their license if they involve patients in, you know, with their illegal activities, they may be at risk of losing a license.
Dr. Jennifer Michaels, I want to ask you a question, a personal question. You are now a genuine superstar, both here at WAMC. We love having you here. And the Berkshire Eagle, our countywide newspaper, is always writing about you and quoting you. Is this a reflection, do you think, of our awareness of the problem? In other words, is the fact that you are so in demand reflective of how we are understanding what addiction, we're bringing it to the forefront in a way it hasn't been there? It's a complicated question.
I absolutely don't feel like a superstar, but I do feel that we have an epidemic, and also a very tragic epidemic. Young people, all walks of life, it's an equal opportunity disease. So every family is affected in some way. Yeah. You know, we know someone or we work with someone. And so I'm sad that it's an epidemic. I'm happy that it's gaining coverage and that hopefully that will help to destigmatize. Because also people who are coming out and acknowledging they have this problem are just regular human beings. You know, they're not these homeless, scary people who hide out in alleyways. They're our neighbors.
Are there enough of you?
I work with some wonderful people, Melinda Randall, Linda Smothers, Alex Sabo, you know, long list of people. They're very dedicated, and I feel very fortunate that we have a strong team. They get it. I mentioned Gail LaShore. She's kind of my partner in treatment at the Breen Center.
And our next door neighbor is a social worker at the Breen Center in Great Barrington.
Ah, okay. Maybe mm-hmm. Dee Dee Aquisto. I mean, there's so many people who do this work because, you know, what we get to see is a rebirth of a person to what they were meant to be. People hear about addiction and the bad things they do, you know, with the stealing, the driving and using drugs and the car crashes.
But that's all true, right?
It's all true.
And every once in a while you see a murder or a shooting in a place like Albany or in Pittsfield.
And because when people are engaged in addiction, they lose their ways and they do things they never could have imagined. When they get help, they get sober, they do things that they never would have imagined. You know, they finish their degrees, they make amends.
But if along the way they've shot somebody.
Those people, you know, they're in jail. But thankfully, the vast majority of people I treat do not shoot people. They're shooting themselves, you know, they're damaging themselves. But the other piece I want to say is that families are involved. And I see the moms and the dads, and they've been through so much. And, you know, that's the collateral damage and the guilt and the powerlessness. So there are groups to support families now in Berkshire County, Learn to Cope. There's Al-Anon. And we want to do more. We want to do more at the Breen Center because it's terrifying.
We are so lucky to have you as part of our team here at WAMC. And to have you in Berkshire County and to have your counsel. We've been talking with Dr. Jennifer Michaels, Medical Director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County, Massachusetts' largest community mental health agency. And it's been terrific to have you, Dr. Michaels. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Alan, thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.